From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Here's something I've learned in all my years of hosting Good Food. The world is small. It doesn't matter where you live. We're connected across mountains, plains, and oceans, not only by what we eat, but by the way we eat. That's especially true in some Asian cities, like former Saigon, where 1/10 of the population makes a living from selling food on the street.
We're using the same storytelling techniques of Chef's Table, but each episode is an ensemble of characters with a single kind of lead that you're following, and the feeling of that city and of that place.
That's David Gelb. He's the creator and director of Chef's Table, the Netflix show about some of the most admired chefs in the culinary world. Now he has another Netflix show, one with a more populist slant. It's called Street Food. And in it, Gelb's team is telling the personal stories of street food vendors, this season specifically in Asia. The series focuses on 9 different cities from Delhi to Seoul. Street food's almost like the anti-Chef's Table, but it is a beautiful counterpart to that series. It's so funny. I remember when you did the first one, and it was seen as something so, I mean, first of all, gorgeous, beautifully shot, elaborate, and now it's just become part of the canon, and everybody just eagerly awaits another volume, like it's an encyclopedia.
Well, thank you. My goodness.
So then you took your lens and your taste, and you focused it on something else completely, street food.
Mm.
Why?
Well, it didn't, when we had the idea for it, it didn't actually feel like it was going to be that different from Chef's Table. And I think that's one of the reasons that we did it. You know, the idea came from when we would shoot Chef's Table, whatever city we were in, we would be taken by the chefs or by the staff of the restaurant or whoever, or by our local fixers, and they would take us to their favorite street food spots. And they would speak about the street food with such passion. Some of these places would have huge lines, and there'd be a bunch of different stalls that were all kind of serving the same thing, but this one place would have the huge hour-long line. We're like, why is that? You know, and what makes it so special? And so we would taste it and we would get the context of it, and the personalities of the street food chefs were really interesting. And you realize that these guys are just as passionate as any 3-star Michelin chef. You know, they're very dedicated. The stakes of their story are often higher than you'd find on Chef's Table because, you know, they're cooking in a lot of cases just to feed their families, just for pure survival even. And we also noticed that, you know, in certain cities like in Bangkok, there was this controversy over, you know, trying to move all the street food vendors into these consolidated locations. And the street food vendors themselves were feeling persecuted. And their clients were none too happy about it either. And so we thought, you know, it's really interesting to be able to tell the story of a city. And in telling that city, you know, the street food is this kind of vibrant center that brings people together and becomes a part of the everyday routine. We're using the same storytelling techniques of Chef's Table, but each episode is an ensemble of characters with a single kind of lead that you're following, and the feeling of that city and of that place, because street food is connected. I mean, it's that there's a reason it's called street food.
Let's start with Jay Phi, the 73-year-old woman known as the Omelet Lady in Bangkok. You couldn't create a more visually intense character if you tried.
Sure. I mean, and that's what's so awesome about documentaries. You find characters far greater than any chef that you could, you know, make up. You know, her story is awesome. Her food is stunning. I mean, the crab omelet or her drunken noodles or these things are cooked so simply, yet so beautifully and elegantly, to the point that she herself got a Michelin star, which is unheard of for a street food vendor. And then her presentation, you know, she's 71 or 72 now. She's in front of this burning hot, you know, white hot flames of this, and she's cooking it all herself on this wok, and she's got her protective glasses on and everything.
She has these goggles on that make her look like a fly. I mean, she's so, like, she's so wiry, super thin, but really muscular.
Yeah, and she has this thing where she says, you know, those other chefs may be younger, but I'm stronger. And, you know, she's like a superhero. I mean, she's incredible.
And it seems that so many of these stories, they have a thread which they share. There seems to be a focus on family, on honoring the family by taking over a business and maybe throwing your own dreams to the wind in the process of doing that. And then the tension between generations. Could you speak a bit about that in the context of the stories?
Sure. Well, going back to Jiro Dreams of Sushi, you know, we realized that it's more than just the story of, it's more than just a cooking story. It's a family story. And I think that everybody can relate to having some sort of issue in the relationships with your parents. I mean, it's a normal thing that you disagree with your parents on things. And when you're sharing a business, the stakes are even higher. And, you know, Yoshikazu was struggling to maintain, this is in Jiro Dreams of Sushi, maintaining the standard of quality and the traditions that his father created. In the case of street food, I think a great example of this is Grace, our chef in Taiwan, and her parents have had this fish head stew for the longest time. And she's trying to modernize it. She's trying to improve the recipe. She's trying to introduce online ordering and like bring it into, you know, into the modern era. And her parents are like fighting her every single step of the way. And I think that a lot of people can relate to that story in their own lives.
And I think the way they tell, the way you present them, so you make them comfortable enough that when they're addressing the camera, telling their stories, they are them. There's so much emotion right below the surface as they're talking. And that arc of the story between Grace and her father, when they're sitting singing in front of the place and she bursts into tears at some point because she's so moved. I mean, it's really amazing. And it's like the children have to trick the parents into letting them take over and make it better.
Mm-hmm. I know Grace is like, you should go on vacation more often so I can bring this, because I can, you know, modernize this business and make it, you know, sustainable.
The other thing that I found really charming was the way, as you say, it's not just the people you're learning about, but the city. And I really felt that particularly in the Osaka segment, which is known as Japan's Kitchen, in which they kind of lay out their own culture as being very different from the rest of Japan's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that there's a certain feeling. We try to choose in our casting a character that really reflects the city.
How did you find Toyo?
And so Toyo, you know, is well known as being this, you know, one of the, I think that Osaka and Toyo represents this, a very kind of a departure from the kind of reserved and measured, you know, the cliche view of the Japanese personality, which is, you know, the nail that sticks out must be hammered down. There's that saying in Japan. And Toyo, and I think Osakans in general, like to stand apart from that. And they really let their personality shine. Toyo is, he's something of a comedian. You know, his food is normal, you know, beautiful. But, you know, it's, there's nothing super deep culinarily that he's doing, except in his presentation and his passion and the way that he cooks using this crazy super-powered blowtorch where he dunks his hand in water and then without using tongs or anything, he uses his hands to manipulate the fish while he's blasting it with this blowtorch. And it's like this show, but he's unlike anyone else.
He also tells people off in line, which they love.
Oh, yeah. And that's part of the Osakan culture, I think. And he makes people like, he'll be like, oh, put this styrofoam box away. And he'll like yell at people to help him. And they all like laugh. He once, somebody said they liked his t-shirt. So he just took the shirt off and gives it to them. He does pull-ups behind the bar. And so that's one of the things that attracted us to him and the series as a whole is that you can have one moment with him where he's hilariously funny and you're laughing. And then you hear kind of the tragic circumstances of his upbringing and how cruel his father was. He couldn't afford school lunch. And so he's out in the fields picking weeds, hoping that something will be edible that he can make as like a weed stir fry. And now he wants to be able to share kind of a warmth and welcomeness that he never really got to experience or only experienced fleetingly when he was a kid. And that's when we really knew the show was working, when you could feel the full breadth of emotion of this guy's life. And, you know, it's only 30-minute episodes, but you really feel it. And I was so moved. And I was so moved by the work that our team did. You know, a lot of the people who worked on it come from Chef's Table. You know, so a camera assistant became a cinematographer, story producers became directors, and, you know, we were able to give everyone a chance to really
shine.
That's
incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
There was another story in Osaka that was one of these stories of generational continuity and the
takoyaki.
Yes, the grateful submission to making one food over and over again for your entire life.
Mm-hmm. I always said that's so remarkable. And that's one of the things I've always loved about Japan is the specialization and the focus. And so this gentleman who is making this exact same takoyaki, which are these fried, delicious fried octopus balls in the same way that his grandparents did. And he's making this one thing and they're just getting that one thing right and being the best at that one thing with no plans to expand beyond being able to continue to do that. I always thought it's so beautiful and moving.
And here we hear a lot that people do these kinds of grinded out jobs so their children will never have to. And he says that he would be thrilled if one of his children decided to follow in his footsteps to keep it, the continuity alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that in some cases, it's always different. You know, I feel like some of the chefs do want to, they work hard so their kids can do something else. And sometimes they're also proud if they choose to do it with them. And I think that every chef has a slightly different perspective on that. I remember in going back to Joe Dreams of Sushi again, you know, Yoshikazu didn't want to be a chef. And then he found that, you know, he just found his way into doing it. And I think that's the case with a lot of the kids of these vendors. They think that they want to do something else, but they're so moved by what their parents do. Or it's just like, I guess kids imitate their parents and they want to continue it. But I'm so grateful that they do, because that's why these recipes and these styles of cooking have lasted, you know, decades and generations.
Yeah, I mean, there was that one town in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm. Yogyakarta.
Where it just seemed like everyone who was making this food is really elderly.
Yeah.
And they're at risk of just losing a whole culture.
That's right. Yeah, because it's a grind, you know, and time seems to move so much faster these days with the way that, you know, we're all on the internet and we have phones and we're globally connected, and people want to, they aspire for, I guess, greater and greater things. I don't know. But, you know, some of the elderly chefs that we've interviewed, and not all this, you know, makes it into the episode, but they do talk about how they kind of regret the lack of patience that young people have. And, you know, I guess we can just be grateful to the people who are willing to keep going and willing to keep making it the same way every day and not looking, you know, for shortcuts.
Singapore in particular is known for the hawker stalls. They brought everybody inside off the streets and created these giant food malls. How has the success of that model endangered their own survival?
It seems like, and this is what we've heard from, you know, people who live in these cities, that many local city governments look at Singapore as this kind of success story, in that they were able to kind of modernize and clean up their streets. And I'm doing air quotes here, because many people don't want their streets to be, again, quotes, cleaned up, because they love having J-Fi or whichever food vendors just wherever they are on their way home. And like, that's part of their daily routine, and don't want to have to go out of their way to visit like a hawker center where they've all kind of been consolidated here. And nothing against the hawker center, but it just seems like most of the people that we're interviewing and that we're seeing in the streets, they just want to keep the tradition of their city the way that it has been. And that the local governments are saying that they are sacrificing street space that is meant for the taxpayers. But it seems like the taxpayers, they want those vendors there, and they want to continue to enjoy that street food in the way that they have going to work, on their way home from work, or just, you know, at lunch or whatever it is.
Do you think that the reason that street food is so intrinsic to daily life in Asia has something to do with the fact that so few people, I mean, the way that kitchens are designed there are very different than ours. There aren't ovens.
Sure.
Often there aren't even really burners. So people actually, some people have to eat out every single
meal. That's right. Yeah. It's like an everyday thing, and it's really affordable. And whether you eat out there or you're taking it home with you. And also, I think that a lot of people seem to go and like hang out at, you know, street food, little joints and stuff like that. And there's little outdoor seating areas on the street. It's like a community. It's like a feeling of getting together. And it can be so isolating. It's the opposite of like ordering Postmates or something like that and just eating by yourself in front of the TV. It's like a little kind of just social, kind of fun kind of scene that people love taking part in, and it's part of their everyday lives, and it kind of just like brings joy, you know?
Did you go to every shoot?
No, unfortunately, I wasn't able to go on every one of these shoots. We did research kind of in advance, but we left it to, you know, these teams that we created that come from, you know, largely come from Chef's Table.
Give me just a personal highlight of when you did go out.
Well, I would say that the experience of J-Fi is incredible. Just seeing J-Fi with her goggles on, her whole, like her gloves and everything. I mean, she just looks like this badass. And the fire is just so intense. And just the visual and the smell of like these omelets frying. And the portion of crab is like incredibly generous
in
there too.
It looks insane.
It's awesome.
Is there going to be a second season?
I mean, gosh, I hope so. You know, we're talking to Netflix right now. We know that we're coming back with two more seasons of Chef's Table, and that's already been announced. And hopefully we can say that Street Food will be back on Netflix for future seasons soon. But season one is now streaming.
It's so wonderful. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Evan.
That's David Gelb, the creator of Chef's Table. We've been talking about his latest series for Netflix, Street Food. It's streaming now. Coming up, a trip to Anaheim's Little Arabia district where there's a remarkable bakery turning out a Lebanese specialty. Patricia Escarcega has more when Good Food returns.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now for a visit with LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. She's back with a new review. Where are we going today?
Today we're headed to Orange County. Specifically, we're headed to the Little Arabia District, one of my favorite places to eat in Southern California.
A lot of people in Los Angeles have never been down there.
That is a shame. I can tell you that I had the luxury of being able to go midweek. So I got there in less than an hour from my home in LA. But if it's a trek for you, I think it's definitely worth the trek to go at least once. Go on a Saturday. A few months ago, I spent a whole Saturday just driving up and down Brookhurst eating. And it was one of the most memorable eating experiences I've had since moving to Los Angeles.
So what specific place are we talking about today?
So today we're going to a very well-established bakery, a neighborhood bakery called Foreign Alahara, and it means a neighborhood bakery.
If we're going to drive all the way down there, are there foods that we can sit and eat at the bakery?
Yes, it's a very casual restaurant, but it is a restaurant. There's seats, there's tables, there's usually a lot of families hanging around. You'll probably meet the owner, Mo Alam. He's a very hospitable. If you tell him it's your first visit, as I did the first time I went there a few months ago, he will probably ply you with treats. I think I got a cheese boat on my first visit. He's very proud of his pastries. He's very proud of his flatbreads, and he wants you to try it before you invest in all those carbs.
So the cheese boat, is it similar to the Georgian flatbread filled with cheese?
Yeah, it is. His are a little smaller, and you can get them with cheese. You can get them with, he does a lot of configurations, so you can get them with a variety of toppings, usually chili powder or parsley, really soft, doughy, cheesy. Really, there's no reason why you, unless you're lactose intolerant, I don't think there's a reason why you wouldn't fall in love with the cheese boat at Foreign Alahara.
So you're talking about dough and you're talking about cheese. Is there anything resembling a pizza there?
Yes. So a lot of people have nicknamed Foreign Alahara the, quote, Arabian pizza place. That's how I found out about it. Somebody suggested I go check out this Arabian pizza place. He does a few pies. He does a kind of simple pizzas where he does a pepperoni, he does a cheese. My favorite is a shrimp. So it's a very thin crust pizza, very lightly sauced, but the shrimp are really plump and very generous with the shrimp. Although you probably don't go there for the pizza is quite good.
So what are we going there for aside from the cheese boat?
You are going there to eat the typical Lebanese breakfast of mana quiche, mana ish sometimes it's labeled on the menu. And this is a really beautiful flatbread, kind of crisp around the edges. Comes in a, you know, infinite variety of toppings. One of my favorites is the falafel mana quiche, if you love falafel the way I do. It's a great dish. It has hummus, it's got chickpeas. He puts some herbs and there's chopped tomatoes. So it really is like you're eating a falafel, but in a flatbread form.
So it's like a deconstructed falafel.
Yeah, it's a deconstructed falafel, and it's really good. I would really recommend, if you love a good sausage with a little spice, try the mana quiche with the sujuk. It's got kind of, if you're familiar with like Mexican-style chorizo, it's got that great vinegary kind of cut through the richness of the sausage. Really good. He is very proud of his sitar spice. He makes it all in-house. You can ask him for a sampling. He'll probably pack some up for you to go so you can use it at home for cooking.
What else did you have there that you loved?
I love just a simple mana quiche with cheese and honey.
Wow, so, that sounds great.
So simple, yet super, just very, very, very good. Let's see. I love his pastries. So he has a really good canafe. This is one of those treats he'll probably ply you with for free. You may get some to take home, but it's really good. According to him, he makes the canafe for a lot of local restaurants. And he says it's so good that some other restaurateurs take his name off the label and add their name. So according to him, if you love canafe in Anaheim, there's a good chance you may be eating his.
And canafe is the pastry that looks like shredded phyllo.
That's right. It's a delicious cheese pastry. It's got chopped pistachios on top. It's got the dyed phyllo strips on top. A really colorful, gooey, really kind of comfort food dessert.
So you said gooey. Does that mean there's baklava as well?
Oh, he makes great baklava. It's another of the dishes that he claims a lot of the local restaurateurs kind of advertise as their own. But it really is a terrific baklava. Just always fresh, which that's sometimes, you know, if you let them, they get a little stale if you wait a few days to eat one. I've had them a few times at Foreign Alhara, and they're always really crisp, just lacquered in that wonderful honey and the nuts. Just really sublime.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
I've been talking with LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega about Foreign Alhara in Anaheim's Little Arabia District. You can find a link to her LA Times review at our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Now we turn to a bona fide legend, a James Beard Hall of Famer who's written some of the most seminal cookbooks about Indian food in the Western world.
Because the steaming basket, for example, you can put all your eggs in one basket, as it were.
That's the great Mader Jaffrey. We've been talking about her latest book called Instantly Indian. It's no secret that I love my instant pot, so I'm thrilled that she's adapted some of the greatest recipes in the Indian culinary canon, specifically for one of my favorite gadgets. Hi, Mader.
Hi, how are you?
Great. It's so great to have you on again. We always love having you. But for this in particular, because I know that Indian home cooks have a very, very long love affair with pressure cookers.
They do. I mean, I grew up in families that all had pressure cookers. Sometimes if they could afford them, they'd have two or three. And they used to whistle. And if you asked anyone a recipe, they would say, oh, yes, cook it to two whistles, cook it to three whistles. And anyone who wasn't an Indian wouldn't know what they were talking about. So this tradition of using pressure cooking for all kinds of food, sometimes they would put two or three things in the same pot. They would put the rice, the dal, which is the split peas, and the vegetable, all in the same pot and cook them at the same time. So this tradition is old and people are familiar with it. So when people say to me, can you cook in an instant pot? I started with saying, no, I don't have an instant pot, but then I got one and I started trying it. And it wasn't all that different from the pressure cooker in India. So I just began adapting recipes to the instant pot, which actually does more than just pressure cook. So you can steam and you can do all kinds of other things that you cannot do in a pressure cooker. So I started learning all the rules and all the things you can do with the rules of the Instant Pot.
Because that's the whole thing, really, when you're learning a new piece of equipment, is first you right. have to read the book, do everything by the rules, and then you can start to adapt to your own style of
right.
cooking.
Right, then you forget the rules because they're in the back of your head. You shouldn't put them out of mind because you need them. You don't want to blow up the Instant Pot. So you keep them in mind, but then you begin adapting. For example, I have to tell you that I made rice in the Instant Pot my way, and all the people who say to me, I can't make rice, it never turns out like yours, what's wrong with what I do? They can make perfect rice in the Instant Pot, absolutely perfect rice, but they have to follow my instructions. Because the Instant Pot instructions make the rice, leave the rice al dente. And in all of Asia, we do not eat al dente rice. Our rice doesn't have a hard core. It's cooked through. The Chinese eat it that way, the Japanese, the Indians. We all like it cooked through. And so if you follow my recipe, you can still hit the rice button. Because what I do is I wash the rice, I soak the rice, drain it, and then I can put it in the pot and hit the rice button, and my rice is perfect.
If you're making something like a biryani, where you have a mixture of meat or other ingredients and the rice, do you do it in a two-step technique, or do you just layer it all in at one time?
You can layer it all in. The trick is you can marinate. For example, if it's meat, you can marinate the meat before, and you have to time it again correctly. The meat and rice will cook through at the same time. But follow the recipe, because I have worked all this out. And it's hard to speak in generalizations, but because it could be a vegetable that you're layering the meat with. It could be just spices that you are cooking the meat with, like a pilaf of some sort. So it depends on what you're mixing with the rice. And then there are dishes unlike, they're like rice but not rice, and we use them a lot. For example, we use semolina to make something called upma. So I have found that if you take quinoa, which is much more nutritious than semolina, and you cook it with vegetables, it becomes like this upma that we cook in India, which is pilaf-like, but not quite as dry as the pilaf, but it has all the spices and the vegetables in it, so it becomes a one-pot meal. And, you know, people just love eating in bowls these days. They put everything in a bowl and add whatever they want to the bowl. So these upma dishes or the dishes that I make with quinoa become bowl dishes that you can then add, put a salad on top or put a little yogurt on top or nothing on top and eat it by itself. And they're quite delicious and very nourishing at the same time.
You know, I have to admit that I have never used the slow cooker function on yeah. my Instant Pot. But after reading this book, I'm going to try. You like using the slow cook function for meats.
For the meat. I do, because it just tenderizes them, and they don't harden. The fat sort of mixes with the meat, and it all becomes one, and you get a texture that I prefer with slow cooking. So this pot does amazing things, many, many things. And the slow cooking is one aspect that I think people should use and should try, because there are times in one life when you say, okay, I'm just going to leave it and let it cook by itself. I'm busy, I have other things to do. And that's a good way to cook meat. It's a wonderful way to cook meat.
Now, I know that there are all different kinds of accessories that one can get for the Instant Pot. What did you find was most useful for you?
Well, I think there are some things that you must get. I think you must get the glass lid. Because when I do fish or clams, if you're doing clams, I like to make the sauce first. Then I cook the fish or the clams in this case on the sauté function. Because I don't want to pressure cook them. The texture is not right for me if I pressure cook them. Generally, I don't pressure cook fish of any kind. So you can put the clams with the glass top, and you can see them opening. And you can say, oh, now they're all open. I don't have to cook 1 second more. So I find that very important. I find the steamer very important. Because the steaming basket, for example, you can put all your eggs in one basket, as it were, and put them into steam. And then we have these wonderful egg curries that some of them are in my book that you can then make the sauce and just cut the eggs and put them in at the end. And it is perfect. It is absolutely, you can get soft-boiled eggs, you can get hard-boiled eggs, you can get something in between. Once you start working with eggs in the steaming basket, you find that you'll never do it any other way.
Now, the one thing that all pressure cookers do incredibly well, as does the Instant Pot, is soups.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
So share a bit of the history of mulligatawny soup with us, would you?
Yes. It's what we call an Anglo-Indian soup. So I can only imagine how it happened that the British were in India and they wanted something Indian and they liked their soups. So they probably said to the chef, make me some kind of soup, but I want that Indian flavoring in it. So the Indian chef probably scratched his head and said, okay, I will make it, I'll put meat in it, but I'll also use the technique of putting chickpea flour to thicken it, which also gives a wonderful taste. And I will put ginger and garlic, and I will make a sauce, and then you eat it with rice. You can put the rice in the soup and eat it. And I'm sure they're thinking that's how it went. But what has happened over time, that there is a community in India that came as a result of the British being there, that they married Indian women or they lived with Indian women and had children. And we have a community in India called the Anglo-Indian community. That's for 400 years old. And they have certain dishes that they make that have traditionally come down through the ages, through their ancestors. And one of them is this mulligatawny soup, which is a favorite Sunday soup of the Anglo-Indian community. And usually what you do is you put rice in it, or you can eat it with rice either way. And I remember after India was independent, this Anglo-Indian family was leaving to go to Australia. Before they left, I said, could you please, please, please give me your recipe for this mulligatawny soup? So mulligu is actually pepper. And tanni is pepper water. So it's a spicy soup, which originally was just black pepper and water and some souring, maybe perhaps tamarind. So that became this mulligatawny soup, which the Anglo-Indian community served and which I pleaded with them to leave me a recipe of before this particular family left to go to Australia. So that's the recipe I sort of use in different ways. Sometimes I make it with chicken, sometimes I make it with lamb. But in India, it would be goat meat that would traditionally be used to make a good mulligatawny soup.
What is the first dish that a young Indian abroad tries to cook?
Well, I find that when I did my very first cookbook, it came out in 1973. Now, that's eons ago.
That is longevity.
That's longevity, too. The students would very often write to me to say that they had made the keema. Now, that is minced or ground meat. In India, you make it out of goat, but I made it out of lamb in the beginning. And that minced lamb with peas is the dish that every student makes. That and dal, a simple dal, which is split peas, cooked with spices. And those are the two dishes that we all learn to make, and then we make rice, and that is a complete sort of basic soul food for a lot of Indians who are starting out. And if they can make that well, they feel, okay, I've got the basics of Indian food, at least for me.
I want to thank you. It's such a lovely little book, and I can see myself spending several weeks just cooking my way through the recipes.
Well, thank you so much for saying that.
That's Madhur Jaffrey. She's the author of many wonderful cookbooks. Her first, An Invitation to Indian Cooking, is in the James Beard Hall of Fame. we've been discussing how to make delicious and instantly Indian recipes using an Instant Pot. It's the subject of her latest book, Instantly Indian. Stoned fruit season is here, and if there's someone who knows what to do with Southern California's wonderful bounty, it's Nicole Rucker. After the break, I'm talking to LA's Pie Queen about her first book, all about baking with fruit. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I remember it vividly. The Good Food Pie Contest judges were on the loading dock of LACMA, taking refuge from the afternoon sun while making final deliberations. Pastry chef Sherry Yard lifted up a whole pie and announced, "This is how you make a crust." Then she picked up another, exclaiming, "And this pie was made by the same person." That person was Nicole Rucker. It was the first time I was introduced to her heaven-sent pies. Nicole won Best Fruit, Crust, and Savory categories that year and took home Best in Show.
I hope more people understand what dappled means because I think it might throw some people off. But
it's
you
a quality
get
of light.
It is. It's such a romantic quality of light, too.
And every photograph in the book is dappled.
I tried. I went for it. I love a theme.
These days, Nicole Rucker is known to some as LA's Pie Queen. Angelinos rave about the way she uses seasonal fruit to marvelous effect in her pies and other baked goods at Fiona on Fairfax. Naturally, I'm over the moon about her new cookbook, her first. It's called Dappled, and it's all about baking with fruit. Hi.
Hi.
You were working at Jelena Takeaway when you did the pie mic drop at our little contest. But when did you first become besotted with fruit?
Oh, when I was very young. I was a really little kid. I think in the time that I grew up, you know, like the early 80s, I was born in 1980, so we were still allowed to like free range and roam around. Free range is what they call it now, but like we just kind of played outside and wandered. And my family taught me what was edible and not edible from a young age, just because that's the things that we talked about. So I knew where there were little strawberries or like a blackberry bush because it was still kind of like wild-ish in the area I grew up in Northeast San Diego.
That's very similar to how I grew up in Silver Lake many decades earlier.
Wandering,
and there was a lot of fruit to pick.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of fruit to pick right now. It's just for some reason people aren't as tuned into it, or maybe they're starting to become more tuned in. But when I was a little kid, also it was the kind of books that I read were all about exploring and homesteading and, you know, being self-sufficient and kind of like dreamy little girl books like Little Women and The Secret Garden and, you know, Wrinkle in Time and Anne of Green Gables all have like a exploration theme. So I think I just had it in my head.
So when did you first start to bake?
Oh, I was very young. I was probably as old as when I could stand, you know, and not be scared of a flame. But we didn't bake anything like real. My family is not a baking family. They made Bisquick biscuits. My grandma made some kind of like Bisquick pizza with apples on it that she probably saw in like Good Housekeeping, but not a lot of desserts.
I think most people expected you to write a pie book. Mm-hmm. But Dappled, although it has this beautiful full chapter on pie, is not that. So why did you make that choice?
Because I think that there's a lot more recipes that fall under the category of fruit and baking that people should look to that are not as expensive both in their time and in their wallet than a pie can be. You know, because the pies I make are expensive. We've talked about this before. They're full of fruit. They're heavy if you use the right pie plate. And that's an investment for someone, especially someone who hasn't baked with a lot of fruit before. So
let's just give a taste of a recipe now. Plums are in season.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the plum yogurt souffle cake.
That's one of my favorites. It's an interesting recipe. It's like a pudding, like a warm pudding that's made with yogurt and eggs. And it just kind of like balloons up in the oven. It has tart fruit on top. And I meant it to be sort of like a breakfasty brunch thing. But I could see it being eaten at night as well for someone who was like trying to be health conscious.
Like eaten as a dessert or eaten for dinner?
I think you could eat it as a dessert, but you know, Who knows what you're going to eat for dinner? People do whatever they want.
One thing that I find so fascinating about people is how scared they get about certain things. Mm. And I've noticed over the years that people have a hard time telling if fruit is ripe.
Mm. Gosh, don't they? Man, it's the biggest. People don't understand anymore.
And it's one of the things that I use to try and get people to go to the farmer's market. I'm like, if you go to a farmer's market, the farmer will teach you.
Oh, yeah. But I just wrote a book about fruit, and I'm going to teach you instead.
So tell us the two different types of fruit when it comes to ripening.
There's fruit that ripens off the vine or the tree, and there's fruit that ripens only on the vine or the tree. Those are called climacteric and non-climacteric. Climacteric fruit will start to release ethylene and change around its like guts on the inside. It converts liquid into sugar, and it changes around some enzymes, and they kind of gas out, and it releases ethylene into the room or the bag or whatever it is, and then it gets riper. There are some fruits that do not ripen by that process, and they won't keep going.
For example, berries.
Berries are a big one. Strawberries in particular are contested. They have some conflicting information about them. Blackberries, definitely not. Raspberries, figs, pineapples.
Which is really sad. You talk about how sad it is that most people have never tasted a fully ripe pineapple.
Yeah.
If you go to Hawaii, you get to do that.
You go to Hawaii, you get to do that. Or some places in Latin America, you can get like a really great pineapple. But yeah, the truth is a lot of us will never have that. Just like a lot of us will never have a sour cherry straight off the tree, you know, because those are two things that just don't travel well. They don't make it.
So in baking, are we looking for super ripe fruit, or are we looking for fruit that is about to become super ripe?
It depends on what your goal is. I would say you want it to be as ripe as possible because you want the most aroma and the most flavor. And ripe fruit has a lot of aroma. And so that's what's really giving you the pleasurable experience, especially with something like nectarines, peaches, and strawberries. They're all about the aroma. Strawberries are mostly aroma. What you're sensing as the strawberry flavor is actually mostly aromatic compounds that are coming out of the berry. So if you have a good strawberry, it's going to smell very potent. Like when you get those Albion strawberries from Jimenez Farms or Seascapes from Harry's Berries. If you leave them in your car for like 15 minutes, you know, while you get a coffee or something, you get back in the car and it's like taking over your entire car because it's just giving off so much aroma. That's what you're trying to capture when you cook with it. So if you're making a recipe that calls for something where the fruit needs to have integrity, maybe do it a little bit off ripe, but you still want as much flavor and as much aroma as possible. So a pear is a good example. A pear
you
is a moving love target.
Pears.
I love pears. You don't love pears?
I never tasted a pear until I was 16 years old in Germany. Mm. And I had a peak pear experience.
Ooh.
And I called my mother from Germany to ask her, collect, mind you, to ask her why she had never fed me a pear. And she said, because I don't like them.
Oh, well, I love an underdog, and pears are so misunderstood, and they have a really important place in fruit history too, and especially in how we propagate fruit and think about fruit ripeness, because pears are mostly eaten flavorless and hard and crunchy, and people think that that's what's supposed to happen when you eat a pear, which is why they're, you know, rejected, and we don't have 50 different varieties of pears meet the market like we have apples, right? We have like four maybe that we get. Even in LA at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. So it's just not fair because they're just misunderstood. Pears ripen really weird. They ripen from the inside out. And also pears have not been bred to not brown. So when a pear gets ripe, it ripens at the center and it leaves a little kind of like it starts to get a brown ring. And people assume that that's rot, but that's not rotten. That's just ripeness. And then I say this in the book, but there's lots of people, poets, who are writing about pears in this like incredibly sensuous, romantic way. That one of the most beautiful lines is that a pear should be eaten with complete silence. No one should ever hear you bite into a pear. It should be so quiet and supple and juicy that nothing is audible. It's like a private moment. So
unlike
if you can't
apple.
Get into it, unlike an apple, which is like a dead giveaway, someone's chomping on an apple and it's annoying, a pear is like the silent, you know, special moment, which if that doesn't turn you on and make you want to eat a ripe pear, then like, I'm sorry, you're lost. Maybe you can have an experience, you know, but you have to wait for it. You get them at the market and then you have to leave them on your counter and you have to wait until they get soft and that might be past your comfort zone.
And then what can we do with them?
Eat them, roast them. I like to roast them. I do a rice pudding with them, roast them with a little sugar, just a tiny bit to encourage like some caramelization and a little bit of alcohol, and then put them on a cold rice pudding or, you know, stick them in a cake. They're great if you put them into a smoothie or make a juice out of them at that point because they give off a lot of flavor. You know, put them in your yogurt. They're
chocolate.
Good. Chocolate. Oh, I do the chocolate and pear cake, but that requires a pear that's a little bit less ripe. It should be just like a day away from perfection.
That's like a great book title.
A day away from perfection.
A day away from perfection. So it's summer.
Yes.
There is stone fruit.
Oh, yes.
You do know how to make a mean pie.
Thank you.
So we have to go there. Talk to me about making the perfect peach pie.
Well, you have to get the perfect peaches first. As I've said many times before, I love the July flame peaches from Tenorelli. Lots of people are growing great peaches. Just in general, I like to add as little additional flavor elements as possible.
Do you peel your peaches?
Sometimes it depends on the skin of the peach, and you would have to eat it to find out. In general, I don't like peach skin, and I like to use nectarines. If the most flavorless product to make a peach pie, in quotation marks, is a nectarine instead, then I'll leave the skin on. If it's a really good peach that has a beautiful colored skin and you can kind of get the hairs off of it and it won't make kind of like a hairy mouth feel, then I would leave it on. It really depends. Some peaches have more little bristles on the outside of them and they really make an astringent flavor in your mouth even when they're cooked. So,
in writing the book, did anything escape your eagle eye? Is there a mistake we should know about?
Oh, God. There's a huge mistake. I don't know if we should say it's huge. It's just a disappointing mistake, but you've written a cookbook before, so you know how hard it is. There is a mistake in one of my favorite recipes, the individual strawberry galettes. But somehow we all missed this mistake, which is the sugar measurement says 2 cups of sugar for 1 pound of strawberries, which is too much sugar for 1 pound of strawberries. And you know that I would never, I mean, that's my calling card is not putting very much sugar.
So what would the correct amount be?
It would be 1/2 cup. But honestly, 1/4 cup if they're really good strawberries, you know, it's hard. Yeah, Carla Lolly Music is the one that found that mistake.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah, she texted me and said, this seems wrong. And I was like, oh, wow, that is wrong. It's my first book. And if you guys buy enough of them, then I can get a reprint and I'll fix the mistake. If not, when I see you at a signing, I will handwrite the correct amount of sugar on that recipe every single time.
That's perfect.
I got to do it.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
That's Pie Queen Nicole Rucker. Her first cookbook, An Ode to Baking with Fruit, is called Dappled. Find her recipe for peach and ricotta biscuit cobbler. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Or if it's too hot to bake, you can try Nicole's creations in person at Fiona, her bakery and cafe on Fairfax, with Chef Sean Pham. In a moment, a visit to the farmer's market where Jillian Ferguson's checking out some stone fruits that are especially drool-worthy this time of year. We're talking eating over the sink, people. Stick around. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Finally, we close out at the Santa Monica Farmer's Market with Jillian Ferguson. She's there with the report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We're back in Santa Monica this week, and I'm talking with Kat Turner. Kat is the chef partner at Highly Likely, a wonderful all-day cafe on Jefferson Boulevard in West Adams. And Kat, I see you here every week at the market. What's catching your eye today?
Today, I am looking for delicious stone fruit. basically all varieties, except for peaches.
Except for peaches. And why not peaches? Is it the fuzzy skin?
I absolutely cannot stand the fuzzy skin. I feel like there's probably like a psychological term for people who can't eat peaches because of the skin. But I do like cooking with them.
Okay. So fortunately for those who hate the fuzzy skin, there are so many other varieties of stone fruit here at the market. What's ending up in your bag today?
Today, I got some really gorgeous Black Splendor plums from Cornelson, Rabata apricots, which like almost shocked me how delicious they were, from Tenorelli, Arctic Star white nectarines, and early Dapple pluots, which are the great like kind of green-hued skin, and they've got like a lovely pink flash.
Mm. So how do all these delicious stone fruit end up on the plate at Highly Likely?
The most kind of simple, straightforward way would be in our fruit bowl, which is my way of showcasing what's the best of the season. So any stone fruit we get is going to be sliced and arranged there. We also make a granola in-house that is full of seeds and gluten-free grains. And I will typically pair that with a type of yogurt. We use whole milk yogurt or cashew yogurt, and then a jam, which oftentimes is also made from the stone fruit. So we have nectarine jam right now, and that's paired with the stone fruit and the granola and the yogurt, which is a nice kind of classic combination. And then for a savory counterpoint, I like to pair it with burrata. Just kind of the salty creaminess of burrata, I think, goes really beautifully with stone fruit. So
yeah, I think one of the best things about the farmers market for home cooks is that the produce here is so good that all you have to do is put it on top of yogurt in the morning or with burrata at dinner, and then you have a beautiful dish.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned the jam. Are you using the white nectarines for the jam?
I do love white nectarines for jam. I think the tartness of a white nectarine and also the color is just lends itself really beautifully to jam. It's a nice kind of rosy hue. Mm. And I think most people expect the stone fruit for jam to be peach. And I think nectarine, a lot of people are like, oh, I've never had nectarine jam before.
With peaches, you would normally take that fuzzy skin off for the jam. For nectarines, do you have to peel them?
No. I leave the skin on, and that's also a lot of where the color comes from, is from the skins.
Mm-hmm. And so what else is going into the jam? You've got nectarines, sugar, of course. Mm-hmm. Any other flavorings?
Kind of depends on the application, because I do use the jam sometimes for savory dishes. If it's going to be used for something sweet, like the granola bowl, I will add just lemon juice along with sugar and the fruit. For a savory dish, I actually like to add pink peppercorns, which also give an interesting texture and a nice pop.
And then what do you pair the savory jam with?
I love pairing the savory jam with a chicken liver mousse, actually.
Well, I was at Highly Likely yesterday. It is an amazing space, delicious food. It's the kind of place that you want to spend an entire afternoon. Thank you so much, Kat.
Oh, thanks, Jillian.
That was Kat Turner. She is the chef partner at Highly Likely on Jefferson Boulevard in West Adams. Troy Regeer of Regeer Family Farms in Dinuba is one of the stone fruit vendors here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market, and he's growing a bunch of classic peaches, a bunch of nectarines. What is the difference between peaches and nectarines other than that fuzzy skin?
Well, I mean, if you look at a tree, a peach tree and a nectarine tree, they look identical. I mean, you could not tell them apart until they actually produced your fruit. So basically, all I could tell you is a nectarine has no fuzz and is more susceptible to rain damage or hail damage in the early spring. Peaches has a fuzzy, kind of a tougher skin, and it's very durable.
So is that fuzzy skin something that the peach developed to protect itself?
Probably, because they are made to grow in a drought-tolerant environment. But most of the people that buy peaches in a store, they don't have the fuzz because they've been washed and waxed. That's what these companies do. We pick ours straight from the tree, right into the box, tree ripe, so they still have that fuzz. So it's kind of a natural way to do it, and it's your choice to wash it off or just eat it fuzzy, but I like to wash it off because it gets pretty nasty sometimes.
That's what Kat was talking about, yeah. You're farming up in Dinuba, and Dinuba is in the foothills of the Sequoia National Forest, right?
It is actually just below the foothills. Okay. It's in a San Joaquin Valley, they call it. I mean, it's called the fruit capital of the world. There is tons of peaches, nectarines, apricots, grapes, and almonds, a lot of citrus now. So, I mean, you see it all. We pretty much provide a lot of the world with stone fruit during the summer.
And is your water coming down from the Sierra Nevadas?
Our water is coming down from the Sierra Nevadas. It's been a great year for water. We've had some drought problems the last 5-6 years. I've had to put a new well in 2 years ago. now the water table is starting to come up a little bit, so it's looking good. So we just want to keep this pattern up to replenish the aquifers down low.
So are you pulling from the well, or are you relying on that ditch water from the Sierra Nevadas?
I am pulling from both. Farming peaches is kind of like an art. When we use our well water, it has more nitrogen in there. Too much nitrogen could lead to watery piece of fruit that doesn't taste real good. So ditch water that comes down from the Sierra Nevadas is pretty much cleansed, and it's natural, and it doesn't have any nitrogen in it. It's a different type of water, and we like using that most of the time because we can control the taste a lot better.
And you come from a line of peach farmers, right? You're a third-generation farmer?
I would say second-generation farmer. Okay. My dad's retired now. He's on his farm in Nebraska, and he left me with all this stuff here, and I have my whole family, my three daughters involved, and we get up at 1:30 in the morning to get here. And we get here at 5:30, and we're unloading a truck and trailer and trying to make everybody happy and bringing them joy.
Troy, you've been coming to this market for...
I think 32 or 33 years. I started in high school, a junior in high school. And now I'm 52, so it's been a long time.
And how many markets do you do in the Los Angeles area?
I just do this one. This one has turned into such a big deal, and I'm really blessed to have this market. It's been so good for our family. I have a good life at home. But we do Santa Barbara on the weekends, too.
Okay, and that's Saturdays?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for all that you do. It always looks great here.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
That was Troy Regier. He comes down, wakes up at 1:30 every Wednesday to come down to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. You can check him out here and also in Santa Barbara on Saturdays. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Yes, we're back on Spotify. And as always, leave us a review if you liked the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Paola Mardo. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.